This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Malaria is an enormous health problem around the world. Traditional strategy for controlling the disease is to kill the mosquito that transmits the malaria parasite. Now scientists have come up with a new idea. As NPR's Jill Palko reports, instead of killing the mosquito, they found a way to let it live while killing the parasite it carries.
There's a kind of fungus that can get under a mosquito's skin, literally.
The insect literally fills up with fungus.
Raymond St. Ledger is at the University of Maryland. Ultimately, filling up with a fungus is a bad thing for the mosquito. In fact, eventually it will kill the mosquito. But in the meantime, St. Ledger realized that he could use genetic engineering to alter the fungus so it would do useful things inside the mosquito.
The trick we did was to engineer the fungus so that it produces a protein which is anti-malarial, anti the parasite itself.
You don't get malaria by being bitten by any old mosquito. You have to be bitten by a mosquito that is carrying the malaria parasite. What St. Ledger's fungus does is rid the mosquito of the malaria parasite.
So the fungus acts like a little hypodermic syringe, and when it's in the blood of the insect, the fungus then produces the anti-malarial protein. And within a couple of days, it basically cures the mosquito of malaria.
And once it's cured, the mosquito can't spread the disease. These findings appear in the latest issue of the journal Science. Now, you might wonder why St. Ledger doesn't just engineer his fungus to kill the mosquito more quickly. Well, they've done that. But St. Ledger says mosquitoes are resourceful. Finding ways to reliably and permanently defend people from mosquitoes is tricky. Insecticides have been used, natural plant toxins have been used.
One by one, all these defenses have fallen as the mosquitoes have managed to outflank every attempt we've made to control them by some evolutionary trick or other.
But because the fungus takes its own sweet time to kill the mosquito, the pressure to use one of those evolutionary tricks to evade the fungus is not as great as it would be with a more lethal insecticide.
Of course, it does open up the prospect that the malaria could become resistant to whatever you put in the fungus.
Andrew Reed is a senior scholar at the Center for Infectious Disease Dynamics at Penn State University. Clearly, the malaria parasite can develop resistance to drugs used to treat it. But Reed says it should be possible by modifying the fungus to keep one step ahead of the parasite. Although this new approach has only been tried in the lab, Reed says it should be ready for field testing before too long.
Because it's already approved for agricultural use for locust control.
Although that's for a version of the fungus that hasn't been engineered to produce anti-malarial proteins. Getting approval to release a genetically modified fungus into the environment will probably take longer, but Reed thinks it will be worth the effort.
One of the great things about this paper and the genetically modified fungi is it does raise the scientific interest a lot in the fungi.
Fungi, or if you prefer fungi or funguses, could be used to inject all manner of deadly toxins into disease-carrying mosquitoes. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
You know, the Oscars aren't just golden statuettes. It's also a television show, and about a billion people around the world will be watching. In addition to stars who are nominees and presenters, this year's musical performers include Mandy Moore, Randy Newman, Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah, she's singing. And that's the fifth grade chorus of Public School 22 in Staten Island, New York. PS22 Chorus has become an internet sensation. They're in Hollywood as we speak, preparing for their performance on tomorrow night's Academy Awards show. The choral director of PS22 is Greg Breinberg, and he joins us from his hotel room in Hollywood. Mr. Breinberg, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. Great to be here.
You know, I have rarely enjoyed preparing for an interview as much as I did watching clips of you and your kids. You guys are great. How'd you wind up on the Oscars?
Bruce Cohen, who's one of the producers of the show this year, turns out to be a big fan of the kids and said, hey, listen, we got an exciting proposition for you. And this was approved by the mayor's office, by the Department of Education. And here we are.
How many youngsters are you out there in Hollywood with?
We are here with 64 fifth graders, 10-year-olds.
Wow, what's that like?
It's loud.
We introduced you with a clip from Firework, which, of course, is a popular Katy Perry song. There is something especially affecting about fifth graders singing a song that tells youngsters you're a firework.
Yeah, and I try to choose music that maybe has a different meaning when the kids sing it. These guys always find a way to just grab their audience and make the music meaningful, and they do us proud here.
You know, I'm very impressed when you watch your videos on YouTube and youngsters talk about you. They say you've helped them put feeling into their music. How do you do that, Mr. Breinberg?
I just like the idea of free expression. I don't tell them, listen, you know, put your hand over your heart when you say this lyric. And the very first lesson they learn in their general music class, which I teach as well, is that if you're not connecting emotionally, you're engaging in maybe mathematics of rhythms and beats and numbers, but it's not music until you infuse that emotion into the performance. And that's one thing that these guys have that I don't think I've ever seen from another group their age.
Greg Reinberg, choral director for the PS22 chorus in Staten Island, New York. You can watch them perform tomorrow night on the Oscars. This is NPR News.
67 bottlenose dolphins have washed up on Gulf Coast beaches over the past few weeks, and more than half were babies. Scientists are trying to determine if there's a link between a spike in dolphin deaths and last year's Gulf of Mexico oil spill. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports that the large number of dead calves is particularly unusual and alarming.
Dolphins have an 11 or 12-month gestation period. These dead baby dolphins were conceived just before the Deepwater Horizon blew up.
So these animals were undergoing development during the height of the oil spill.
Terry Rawls is the top marine mammal scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. She says it's very worrisome to see such a large number of marine mammals die.
The oil spill is definitely on our list of potential causes, but we're certainly not ruling in or out any causes at this point.
At least two of the dead calves found over the last few days had what looked like oil on their faces. Mandy Tumlin is the Marine Mammal Strandings Coordinator for the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. She says those calves were discovered by cleanup crews surveying the beach of Grand Terre Island in southeast Louisiana.
We're concerned, but we really can't speculate. There's a lot of factors that could play a role in an animal's death.
Tumlin doesn't expect to be able to confirm any cause of death until all the samples from the animals come back from labs. Most of the dead dolphin calves were found on the beaches of Alabama and Mississippi. Staff from the Institute for Marine Mammal Studies collected them. Moby Salangi directs that institute. He says some of the calves were stillborn, some were premature, and some died shortly after birth.
It is very, very strange. Usually we see one or two calves, but this year it's just a very, very large number.
His staff took samples from the decomposed carcasses and is doing autopsies on the dead dolphins that were still intact.
We are doing a forensic study, and we're trying to put all the pieces of the puzzle together.
Imagine CSI or Bones, but the victims are dolphins. One of Salangi's working theories is these dolphins' mothers ate fish contaminated with BP oil. Those contaminants pass through the mother's bloodstreams to the fetuses. But there are other possibilities. Researchers are looking for signs of an infectious disease. They'll also investigate whether the unusually cold winter played a role. A toxic algal bloom is another suspect. Even if the oil spill did not directly cause these deaths, it still could be a factor. Veterinary pathologist Greg Bossert is a dolphin expert at the Georgia Aquarium. He says researchers are still trying to tease out all the ways BP oil affected the Gulf's ecosystem.
When those interactions become unbalanced from the oil, then you're prone to seeing, you know, new diseases emerge, predator-prey relationships change, temperatures change, and chemistry of the ocean change, and all those indirectly affect the health of organisms.
Experts say since dolphins are at the top of the food chain, they reflect what has happened to their environment.
What we do know is dolphins can be very good sentinels for what's happening in our oceans and even what's happening in our own bodies.
Dead dolphins keep washing up day after day. Scientists say they'll investigate every animal they find. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time for sports. Madness, I tell you. Sheer madness. March Madness up ahead. Mellow Madness is here, so we've loosened the straps on the straitjacket of NPR's Tom Goldman, who joins us. Good morning, Tom.
Hi, Scott.
You know, this weekend, when you usually when you mention big college basketball games, you might think Duke, Carolina, Texas, Kansas, right? Arizona, UCLA. But this weekend's right. top game is Brigham Young, the university in Utah, not the guy. Brigham Young versus San Diego State. Yeah, that was a good. That wasn't a bad ad lib. So, how did these two teams from a conference that is not considered a basketball power become the game to watch and perhaps the two teams to watch this year?
Well, they're really good. BYU is ranked number 7th in the nation in the AP poll. San Diego State number 6 in the AP, number 4 in another poll. You know, in a season when no men's college basketball team is showing utter dominance, why not believe that these teams could go far in the NCAA tournament next month? Now, the game on CBS today reportedly is the first time two Mountain West Conference teams in any sport is being televised live by an over-the-air network. And, you know, it's quite a big deal. And not to needlessly oots the BCS, Scott, the college football's postseason event.
Yeah.
But one thinks about how another Mountain West team, undefeated TCU, was left out of last season's championship football game because, of course, there's no playoff in college football. Of course, that's not the case in men's basketball. BYU, San Diego State will get their shot to represent the Mountain West and maybe at the Mountain Top.
Yeah. Oh.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, all right. That's not a bad one. Jim Fredette scored 43 points last time they met. San Diego can change that now?
Tough to do. You know, after that 43-point performance, NBA star Kevin Durant, who's pretty good offensively himself, he tweeted, "Jimmer Fredette is the best scorer in the world." And last year, Fredette scored 33 points against San Diego State, even when he had strep throat and mono. But San Diego State has a very tough defensive team. In fact, defense is the Aztecs' specialty. Plus, they're playing the game at the Aztecs' Viejas Arena. It will be rocking because Aztec fans are treating this like the biggest game ever.
Big NBA news this week, of course. Carmelo Anthony and some Denver Nuggets went to the New York Knicks in exchange for 4 players, some draft picks, and I think Croatia's gross national product. But, you know, they still couldn't beat the mighty Cleveland Cavaliers last night, could they?
I love that. That's so funny.
That aside, does this readdress the East-West balance of power in the NBA?
Well, you know, yes, Carmelo is in New York, Deron Williams in New Jersey. That certainly sends some top dogs to the East. You got those guys in Miami, of course, those big three. But, you know, Boston sending Kendrick Perkins to Oklahoma City, that people are still scratching their heads about that and say that that may weaken the best team in the East, Boston. Mm-hmm. San Antonio is still considered the best team in the NBA right now. The Lakers are the 2-time defending champs. So the West isn't forgotten by any stretch.
And there seems to be some concern, I've read this in a few places, within the NBA, that they might be becoming a league of half a dozen major market teams, you know, the ones in New York, Chicago, L.A., Boston, and Miami, leaving the rest of the league as kind of minor league franchises that just feed talent to the major teams.
Mm-hmm. Well, concern, I think, is too strong a term. In fact, it is. An NBA official told me that. But is the NBA aware? Yes. And is the NBA monitoring this? Yes. Stars mean a lot more in the NBA because they can directly affect the outcome of games more so than stars in the NFL and Major League Baseball. So the NBA is aware that too many of these guys in a few places could make this league, you know, as you say, a league of haves and have-nots. That NBA official told me yesterday the league would like to be more NFL-ish, as he said, more parity, more fans truly believing their team has an honest shot at winning the title. And so the NBA has some ideas floating around how to limit the clumping of stars, and those ideas may pop up in upcoming labor negotiations.
Sad event this morning, too. Funeral services in Chicago for former NFL safety Dave Duerson. Wonderful career, of course, played on the 85 Super Bowl champion Bears and then later Super Bowl team for the Giants. He shot himself to death in the chest February 17th. Dave Duerson was 50, smart, delightful. He left a note asking his brain be examined for possible damage during his playing days. This could have real repercussions.
Well, it could. And you know, there are still coulds and perhapses surrounding the story. You know, he said reportedly he texted his family that he wants his brain to be examined for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE. It's a brain disease linked to depression and suicide. Some football players, retirees have shown this. We still don't know about Duerson, and this is another case, and if it's football related. But yes, this issue, we're told, is part of current labor negotiations between the NFL and its players union.
Yeah, we should note he also, unfortunately, had a lot of financial problems and personal problems.
Right.
And NPR's Tom Goldman, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
There's a group of islands in the South Pacific that you probably haven't heard much about, and there won't be much time to get to know them. The Carteret Islands will be consumed by rising sea levels in the near future, and its people will be displaced. The story of the islands and their people is the subject of a documentary called Sun Comes Up. It's nominated for an Oscar in the Best Documentary Short Subject category. And as Karen Michelle reports, the film brought together its director and its cinematographer in more ways than one.
Sun Come Up follows a group of islanders as they seek a new home.
Last year, we had banana trees, sugarcane, swamp taro. The beginning of this year, we had this king tide, and this area here was flooded with pure salt water, destroyed everything we planted. The place is turned into a small desert.
The desert is on the Carteret Islands in the South Pacific. Within the next few years, the islands will cease to exist as the sea swallows the land.
This is the end of the island. Everybody will be moved out.
Director Jennifer Redfern first learned of the Carteret Islanders' plight in June 2008.
I was shocked because I didn't know that people were being displaced by climate change right now. And I thought, well, if I don't know that, and I have a background in environmental science and journalism, then probably a lot of other people don't know that. And so it struck me as an incredibly important and also compelling story to tell.
I got an email out of the blue from someone I didn't know, saying, would I be interested in meeting to potentially shoot a film in the South Pacific? And so I thought, sure, let's meet.
Tim Metzger is a freelance cinematographer. Jennifer Redfern had heard of him, got in touch, and told him the deal. Their travel expenses would be covered, but neither he nor she would be paid. She had some savings, he had some equipment.
It was just a question of, was I willing to give a month and a half, possibly 2 months of my time, and was I willing to go to the South Pacific with this charming young woman? And of course I said yes.
Maybe you heard that tone of his and that laugh of theirs. Well, spending weeks schlepping gear, powering it with solar cells, rationing water, bathing in the sea, and having very limited food.
We fell in love during the process of making the film, and I think for both of us it was something that we had wanted to do for a very long time, and both fall in love, but also make a film about something that we cared deeply about, and all of those things came together during this project.
As outsiders, Redfern and Metzger quickly bonded, not just with each other, but with the islanders. The film gives the impression that the two outsiders weren't even there.
In every village we would go to, the leaders of the village would announce our presence. They would get up and say at the start of the gathering, if you're wondering who these white people are, they're making a film, you know, they're traveling with us. At pretty much every village we went to, you'd think that maybe people would be staring at us. But really the most interesting thing for them was, who are the Carteret Islanders?
They went from village to village pleading their case. There were times the filmmakers didn't really understand what was going on.
And we play facing big problems right alongside Blong Kai Kai.
The chief of this village said, when you are here, don't feel afraid. Just feel that you are at home.
It wasn't until later, after getting the footage translated, that Metzger and Redfern learned they'd filmed a critical moment when a village in Bougainville offered to take in the Carteret Islanders. That surprise was not too different from the way they learned that their first ever film had been nominated for an Academy Award.
Yeah, we got two separate FedEx packages sitting next to each other in our joint mailbox.
Do you have it here?
Yeah.
Let me see.
I'll show you. That's our invitation. Yes, that's our invitation to the 83rd Academy Awards ceremony. And it came in this beautiful black envelope.
It's like getting a wedding invitation.
It is like getting a wedding invitation. It came in this fancy envelope. So I don't think it's a hoax, but you never know.
Jennifer Redfern and Tim Metzger are now in L.A., getting ready for the big night. Tim's rented a tux. Jennifer's got a good deal, she says, and a designer gown. In a way, it is like a wedding, the wedding they plan to have. For NPR News, I'm Karen Michelle.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.